With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Danielle Leal.
Hey everyone, Danielle Leal here, and thanks for getting your agriculture news with me today. Animal Agriculture Alliance has announced the theme of its 2024 Stakeholder Summit. That theme is Ready, Set, Solve, Advancing Animal Agriculture. The event will take place May 8th through the 9th in Kansas City, Missouri. The Alliance's president and CEO, Hannah Thompson-Weeman, says, quote, "The annual Stakeholder Summit is known for its dynamic speaker-filled schedule, and the 2024 summit will be no different. The Alliance team is excited to tap into the 2024 Olympics theme with an emphasis on propelling animal agriculture toward the ever-evolving finish line as we all work to reach our collective goals. We look forward to curating an agenda that embodies this focus." Registration for the summit will open up early next year. However, the Alliance is currently taking applications to be a speaker for the event through November 22nd. If you'd like to find out more information, you can visit animalagalliance.org. And now let's get into today's show headlines. 2024 brings changes to minimum wage and overtime. As we inch closer to the start of the new year, Teresa Keene, president and CEO of AgSafe, shares a few reminders about changes in the minimum wage rate and work week hours.
So I want to make sure, again, folks remember minimum wage is going up to $16 an hour. Also remember that we have overtime as well for ag workers. Overtime has been overtime for ag workers for large companies, so 26 or more employees, is now at 40 hours a work week, so like most everybody else. But small employers were still ratcheting up or ratcheting down to that 40 hours. So overtime for ag workers and for small employers is going to be 45 hours a week or 8.5 hours per day. So just want to make sure that people are paying attention to that. And in 2025, then everybody will be the same in the ag industry. It'll be 8 hours a day, a 40-hour work week.
And while the rule to increase the minimum wage was set to cap at $15, a 3.5% increase in the state minimum wage was mandated to address inflation. Now, this rule applies for all employers, and it means that the rate could increase with each year. And now here's AgNet West, Brian German, with more agriculture news.
Applications for the Agricultural Conservation Easement Program are currently being accepted by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Applications for the ACEP program are available through the Inflation Reduction Act. USDA's Natural Resources Conservation Service will be accepting applications for this special funding until November 13th. To qualify, the land must meet specified conditions and be located within national priority areas. There are two components to the ACEP program. Agricultural land easements help private and tribal landowners protect croplands and grasslands on working farms and ranches by limiting non-agricultural uses of the land through conservation easements. Wetland reserve easements help private and tribal landowners protect, restore, and enhance wetlands which have been previously degraded due to agricultural uses. More information about ACEP opportunities is available at agnetwest.com. Cattle on feed numbers began the month of October, just a bit ahead of last year. USDA livestock analyst Shale Shagum highlights some of the key numbers from USDA's cattle on feed report.
The number of cattle on feed on October 1st was just under 11.6 million head, which was about 1% above a year ago and would be the second highest October 1st inventory number since the series began in 1996. During September, approximately 2.2 million head of cattle were placed on feed, which was about 6% above a year ago. Feedlots marketed just under 1.7 million head during September, which was about 11% below a year ago. But when we adjusted for the fact that there was one less slaughter day in September this year compared to last year, marketings were actually only about 6% below a year ago.
I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
You're listening to AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
How are GMO plants made? First, scientists look for a desired trait in a plant, animal, or even bacteria. It could be a trait like resistance to drought, insects, or viruses. Then they copy the gene that contains that trait. and insert it into the DNA of the plant they want to improve. Scientists then grow that plant to see if it adopts the desired trait. Feed your mind with more GMO facts on FDA's website.
Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal, tossing it right on over to Sabrina Halverson with today's National Spotlight.
In today's National Spotlight, as the House continues its search for a new speaker, some members of the Senate are watching and waiting for the legislative work to continue, especially when it comes to the Farm Bill. Senator Kevin Cramer of North Dakota expects a Farm Bill extension. I spoke with the senator on the phone Tuesday.
I think it's getting more and more unlikely that there'd be a Farm Bill done yet this year. It's not impossible. There's still enough time on the clock to do it. There's some political will to do it, but as you point out, the dysfunction in the House makes it literally impossible for them to deal with it because they can't even have, you know, significant committee meetings and certainly can't conduct any committee business in terms of a markup or anything like that. That said, one of the ideas that has floated around for a long time, but Senator Bozeman, the ranking Republican on the Senate Ag Committee, has suggested a one-year Farm Bill extension. And that's probably appropriate in this case, because one of the things we don't like to do, there's a time for deadlines and cliffs, and there's a motivating factor to all of that. But farm bills have generally been pretty, amicably debated, if you will. There's a lot of mandatory spending in farm bills. There are a lot of mandatory programs in farm bills. And there's even a little bit of a check and balance in terms of how the permanent law kicks in if a new law is not passed. So there are plenty of incentives for us to get our work done. But another year might be useful in putting some of these things together and putting them on paper while we wait for the House to get its act together. Largely because the current Farm Bill, or really the last 5-year Farm Bill, is still pretty good law, and I think agriculture by and large, and more importantly, the extension of agriculture being the banker, can live pretty well with an extension of the current Farm Bill, and certainly much better than one that actually runs out of money and runs out of authorities, which happens. I don't mean to get super wonky on all this, but the Farm Bill is built in a way that, to run for 5 years and then, either be changed or extended. But there are parts of the Farm Bill that run calendar year. So they run January through December, and parts of the Farm Bill that run during the fiscal year. And so we have some of that overlap going on right now with our continuing resolution. There's quite a bit of money in the system, and so farmers aren't really feeling an immediate pinch. But as you prepare for next year's crop, your banker and your insurance company, they all want to know what the rules of the game are going to be. And that's why I think a one-year extension would provide that certainty over the course of the next, 10 to 12 months, while we could work on a farm bill that wouldn't require all 10 or 12 of those months, perhaps, but at least there'd be that certainty so that the business of agriculture could move forward.
Yeah, which is probably eases the minds of those in the ag industry around the nation.
For sure. Yeah. And the sooner we do that, in my view, the more breathing room we get and the more breathing room that those that are planting, as just because you might plant in the spring, depending on what, spring comes depending on, for different people in different parts of the country. But we're to that point where the planting is well underway, even as harvest, the last things are being harvested right now in the Great Plains. Those things are being determined right now, and those discussions are taking place between farmers and bankers. And as we have the additional inflationary costs of inputs, and we have higher interest rates. And so all the more reason for certainty and early planning to take place. So we need to provide, I think, that breathing room.
That's today's National Spotlight. I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
Thanks, Sabrina. And now for today's Livestock Report, here's Randall Wiseman.
Well, in today's livestock news, the dairy industry held a big celebration event last week that was well attended. According to a story from Will Jordan, it included various programs and sessions.
The International Dairy Federation World Dairy Summit was held last week in Chicago. Over 1,240 dairy leaders from 55 countries gathered to celebrate the 120th anniversary of IDF. As the first World Dairy Summit held in the United States in 30 years, the event highlighted dairy's innovations, marketing opportunities, and contributions to global sustainability, food security, and more. IDF President Pierre Cristiano Brasale and Director General Caroline Emond, along with the U.S. IDF co-chairs Nick Gardner and Shauna Morris, emphasized the importance of bringing the global dairy sector together and released a declaration statement that called on governments, global organizations, and the world's food and beverage sector to support Being Dairy. The summit delivered 4 days of dynamic programming, and IDF also released the World Dairy Situation Report 2023, its 2022-2023 annual report, and announced the winners of its second annual IDF Dairy Innovation Awards, which celebrate and encourage innovative practices across the world.
For Agnet Media, I'm Will Jordan.
Thanks, Will. And how does USDA's October outlook on beef production connect with its price forecast for this and next year? Well, Rod Bain has more on that, along with a look at broiler and turkey production and price forecast.
More production expected both this year and next regarding beef, although small, according to USDA World Agricultural Outlook Board Chair Mark Jekinowski.
Raised our current year beef production forecast by about 40 million pounds, mainly reflecting higher cow slaughter. For 2024, we raised the production forecast about 110 million pounds, essentially reflecting the fact that more cattle came into feedlots late in 2023, so they will be available into next year for beef production.
He adds increased beef production translates in part to lower steer prices.
Prices for the current calendar year, we reduced by $1.18 per hundredweight, reflecting recently observed price developments. We expect that relative weakness to carry into at least the first half of 2024, so we reduced our steer price forecast by 50 cents per hundredweight, and that mainly is reflecting a little bit of price softness in the first half of the year, but they are likely to strengthen again in the second half.
When it comes to poultry production forecasts for both this year and next,
broiler and turkey production both down for both years, 2023 and 2024.
Jekinowski explains.
The broiler industry is in a bit of a correcting mode, reducing supplies due to relatively lower prices and weaker demand. Turkeys as well, lower implied production from hatchery data and also lower weights.
Price forecast, however, are mixed.
Broiler prices we raised in 2023, 0.8 cents per pound, and for 2024, we raised it by a penny per pound. But turkey price forecast for 2023, we lowered by 4.6 cents per pound, and for 2024, we lowered it by 8.8 cents per pound.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Thanks, Rod, and I'm Randall Wiseman for Agnet West.
This is the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search Agnet News Hour or Agnet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's Agnet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
If your soil could talk, what would it say? If it's healthy, it may already be saying some good things about your future. Because farmers who use soil health building systems that include no-till, cover crops, and diverse species and rotations report greater productivity, profitability, and resiliency to weather extremes. Learn more about what your soil is saying about its health and your future. Contact your local USDA Natural Resources Conservation Service office today. This message brought to you by USDA and this radio station.
You've been listening to the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now.
How much small business pandemic help did farmers get? That's coming up on This Land of Ours. Researchers at USDA's Economic Research Service estimated that the Paycheck Protection Program provided $5.8 billion to the farm sector in 2020. The PPP was a non-USDA assistance program for small businesses adversely affected by the pandemic. Total federal government payments to the farm sector in 2020 were $45.6 billion, meaning that the PPP payments were 13% of total payments. The Small Business Administration administered the PPP, providing forgivable loans to eligible small businesses and certain other entities to allow them to cover some of their payroll costs. The PPP loans were forgiven in full if the loan was used on eligible expenses. Agricultural producers in California were the largest recipients of PPP loans at $1.1 billion. California leads the nation in value of agricultural production and has the highest hired labor expenses among the states. I am Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
This is the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McCohen. If your farm is structured in some form of business entity that must be filed with the state, there's a new reporting requirement that starts on January 1, 2024 that might apply to you. Your farming operation might be subject to new regulations requiring the reporting of beneficial ownership information. It's an anti-money laundering initiative designed to catch those that are using shell corporations to avoid tax. Companies created in 2024 have 90 days from being registered with the state to file initial reports disclosing the persons that own or control the business. If your business was created or registered to do business before 2024, you have until January 1 of 2025 to file the initial report. Businesses formed after 2024 must file within 30 days of formation. Farm entities that have at least 20 employees, report at least $5 million on the latest filed tax return, and have a physical presence in the U.S. are exempt. But many of these exempt farms might have other businesses that will need to file, such as an equipment or land LLC or any other related entity. In these situations, having one large farm entity won't exempt the others. The penalty for not filing is steep, so make sure to have your attorney complete the paperwork and file the report. This has been the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McCohen.
The American Farm Bureau Federation's 2024 convention is quickly approaching, and this year the organization is partnering with 4-H, FFA, and Manners to offer free registration to youth members. David Townsend, Assistant Director of Member Engagement, says this partnership ties perfectly into the convention's theme of new frontiers.
This means that we're also looking to the future of agriculture, food, and natural resources by highlighting the work of our partnering youth organizations. This convention offers a snapshot of various opportunities available for Farm Bureau members at the local level as well, that Junior Manners, 4-H, and FFA members can get a view of at convention and then implement back home. There's just so much that happens at convention that is a great representation of ways that youth and agriculture can get involved.
The Sunday schedule includes programming specifically focused on youth. Townsend talks about why young people should be interested in the National Convention.
If middle school and high school age members are curious about how to get involved with Farm Bureau, convention is the place that offers a great look into what's available for the organization, but without the cost of a registration fee. This free registration for youth members includes the entire convention experience. And on Sunday, January 21st, we host an intentional youth convention experience that we call the Youth Leadership Program. It includes a leadership development training, free attendance for a youth-focused leadership luncheon this year.
He says the collaboration between the American Farm Bureau and youth organizations is important to everyone involved.
At Farm Bureau, partnering with organizations aimed at similar goals that we have in cultivating young ag leaders is an important priority and part of how we support youth. A huge part of this is because Farm Bureau needs the brightest minds and hardest workers ready to solve agriculture's challenges and explore new opportunities together. And we can't do it alone. So partnerships are essential to the success of the industry of agriculture, food, and natural resources.
For more information, go to annualconvention.fb.org. Chad Smith, Washington.
We take a look at the latest cotton crop conditions. USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey gives us an update on the condition of the nation's cotton crop.
We're seeing drought issues again this year, especially in the southern Great Plains. Just 29% of U.S. cotton rated good to excellent, 43% very poor to poor, unchanged from a week ago. Compare those numbers to this time in 2022. In late October of 2022, we had 30% of the crop good to excellent and 45% very poor to poor. Getting back to this year's crop, those low numbers mostly coming in from the Southern Plains, Texas, leading the nation, 66% very poor to poor, closely followed by Oklahoma at 48%. A little further down the list, we have Kansas, 26% very poor to poor. And of course, that drought did spread into the Gulf Coast region. Louisiana cotton, 26% very poor to poor.
I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
This is the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search AgNet News Hour or AgNet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's AgNet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
You're going to need me.
You're going to need us.
All of us.
You're going to need our help with your water. Your air, your food.
You're going to need our determination, our compassion.
You're going to need the next generation of leaders to face the challenges the future will bring.
And we promise we'll be there when you need us.
Today, 4-H is growing the next generation of leaders. Support us at 4-H.org.
Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West, providing you with statewide agriculture news daily. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Now let's listen in to more featured segments.
The corporate earnings season continues on Wall Street, while grain and livestock futures look for some stability on LaSalle Street in Chicago. I'm Mark Oppold with your bottom line report at midweek, brought to you by Kloss Equipment. Maximize your harvest potential with the efficiency, reliability, and the affordability of the Kloss Trion 740 Combine. Take a closer look at Kloss.com. Over 1,000 companies listed on the Dow and NASDAQ will report earnings between now and Friday. Today's group includes the CME Group and Farmland Partners. Tomorrow, A.O. Smith, Bunge Corporation, Merck & Company, Valmont Industries, and Tractor Supply Company. So far, 77% of companies reporting are meeting or beating estimates, but the Dow ended a four-day slump, took them below 33,000. The S&P 500 hovers above 4,200. Last time it went below that was back on May 31st. This is the bottom line report. Grain futures continue looking for a base as harvest rolls to its last 25%. December corn looks to hold 480 in our view. January soybeans continue to battle that $13 level. December, Kansas City wheat at 655. Live cattle, December may have set their low just above 177 yesterday. I'm Mark Oppold, wishing you a profitable day.
Agritourism. This form of agribusiness has been around for some time now.
I say, have you ever gone to a pumpkin patch? Or have you ever gone to the flowers on a farm? And most people can at least say, yes, some form of that. And you participated in agritourism, maybe not even knowing it.
And as Oregon State University Extension expert Audrey Comerford notes, it is expected to continue growing, both in numbers of operations and popularity among consumers. That's not to say, though, there isn't challenges in starting up or maintaining an agritourism site. But she observes, for many in this business,
the folks that are actively engaging in agritourism are seeing the benefits and are looking to expand.
I'm Rod Bain. Coming up, a look at agritourism in this edition of Agriculture USA. There are several reasons ag producers decide to pursue agritourism. Yet, as Oregon State University Extension's Audrey Comerford explains, benefits also greatly vary, both for the business owner and operator and their customers. From the economic perspective,
it may allow the farms to charge a higher price for their farm products. It's not getting easier to be a farmer. Engaging directly with customers to promote the sale of product, that's another positive benefit. It may improve farm viability by adding additional revenue stream.
In addition,
it can also allow the farmer ranch to employ additional family members or maybe even a community member on the farm, either part or full time.
Agritourism can also aid in farm succession,
where the second, third, or fourth, or even fifth generation to that farm maybe is looking to put their own spin on it. And by adding these direct consumer sales or on-farm events, lets them carve out a niche in their family business.
As the COVID-19 pandemic demonstrated, agritourism provides provides a relationship building opportunity with local communities.
Folks were looking either to get out of the house, connect with their local food systems. So while that community relationship building has always been there, we saw it strengthen a lot during the pandemic.
Several agritourism operations are not operated as a business by the farm owner, but rather to educate the public about agriculture.
There's a larger disconnect between what happens on farmland, how food and fiber is grown and processed, and what the public knows or perceives. And so these farms that open up to the public really provide that education about what goes on in our agriculture sectors here in the U.S.
Cumber Ford says even with the educational component of agritourism as a sole focus, there still could be an indirect residual effect for the business side of such an operation.
Even using it as a marketing, so later these folks then think about the farm and will maybe buy their product from them rather than someone else.
For those considering starting up an agritourism business, Audrey Cumberford says this industry has its share of challenges. For instance, there are what is known as ongoing challenges.
One of the big ones that comes up is land use laws, zoning, and permitting. What these folks can and cannot do on farmlands based at a state and county level. There's always the question of infrastructure, what kind of buildings, parking lots, restroom facilities, those types of things need to be added to the farm to have visitors on the property.
Risk management, insurance, and liability are also important considerations, perhaps challenges, for an agritourism operator.
You're always going to have risks when inviting the public onto the property, and is it worth that particular risk to your operation and your family?
She adds risk management includes proper biosecurity measures to assure everyone, farm operator and family, employees, visitors, and animals, remain safe. She also notes another challenge for producers with agritourism ongoing on their farm. Lack of privacy.
Loss of privacy is a big one. You must actually want people on your farm and to interact with the public in order to do agritourism. If you don't, then maybe this avenue of marketing isn't necessarily for you.
Then there is the usual list of challenges associated with any ag operation, including agritourism.
Time management, labor, increase in cost, marketing.
Despite the challenges of the pandemic, agritourism utilized online sales as another revenue stream. Various on-site activities curtailed during the pandemic are returning. And Cumberford says owners are continuing to look at ways to diversify what they offer through agritourism.
For one, on-farm lodging, so farm stays, is quite popular right now. How can we take some of those folks that are staying and vacationing in rural areas and put them and their dollars out into the rural communities?
This has been Agriculture USA. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
This is the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search Agnet News Hour or Agnet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's Agnet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
What GMO crops are grown and sold in the U.S.? Well, there's corn, like me, soybeans, canola, sugar beets, and cotton. Typically, we're ingredients in certain foods. GMO alfalfa, corn, soybeans, canola, and cotton are used as animal food. And while you won't find many GMOs in the produce section, there are versions of GMO apple, summer squash, potato, and papaya in a few markets. Feed your mind with more GMO knowledge on FDA's website.
Welcome back to the show. For today's interview segment, we have the latest episode of the Vineyard Team's podcast, this time discussing all about balancing hot climate and how high temperatures and extreme weather events can have numerous impacts on wine grapes and wine quality. Here's show host Craig McMillan.
And my guest today is Andrea Batazatu. She is Associate Professor and Extension Enology Specialist at Texas A&M University, the Texas AgriLife Service. Thanks for being our guest today.
Thank you for having me.
We're very interested in some of the work you've been doing recently around effects of warming climates on vines and on wines. You're an enologist in particular. You've been doing work on wine quality. Is that correct?
Correct, yes.
And you've been doing work in Texas, obviously.
I have, yes, for the past 7 years or so, yeah.
And would you say that temperatures during the growing season in Texas overall have been increasing?
I would, yes. The temperatures historically have been increasing. And furthermore, we see a lot more extreme weather events. So temperature records being broken, as well as, like I said, extreme weather, storms, winds, hail, a lot of hail. We've been having quite a bit of hail in Texas. So these can affect the process of grape growing.
Absolutely. So definitely there's been some changes. How has this been affecting wine quality? What particular parameters are being most affected?
Right. So this is a not straightforward answer for this question, because several things can happen when you have extreme weather events and temperatures rising. The biggest one that we see here is a changing ripening patterns. So sugar accumulation and acid degradation, they kind of change. Sugar tends to accumulate much faster because of the earlier heat. We tend to see earlier ripening, so earlier harvesting. Sugar accumulates faster, acids degrade quite a bit. The ripening is not linear anymore, so we see ripening in terms of sugar, but we don't see that in terms of tannins or aroma compounds or maturation of the seeds. So there's a bit of disconnect there. That's one thing. Because of the higher sugar accumulation, we tend to see higher levels of alcohols in wine, which is not necessarily a good thing. There's only so much alcohol that you want to have in wine. It becomes overbearing and unpleasant, and the wines will be unbalanced. Most importantly for us in Texas, and I'm sure for any other grape growing region that deals with high temperatures, is an increase in pH. Because of acid degradation, we see grapes coming in with very low titratable acidity. We're talking 3-4 grams per liter. And then pHs of 4 and above.
Wow.
Yeah. Yes. Wow, indeed. Very, very high pHs that we have to deal with as winemakers. As I'm sure your audience knows, high pH can cause a host of problems in wine quality, problems from microbiological instabilities and compromising wine quality that way to color instability, aroma and flavor balance, all of that. So that's a big thing that's happening.
And those higher sugars are also problematic just for getting your fermentations done.
Absolutely. You can have problems starting your fermentations. You can have problems finishing your fermentations.
What kinds of things are winemakers doing to try to manage these factors? But what kinds of things are you looking at to try to manage these factors?
Right. So my research here at A&M is focused on acidity and acidity management, again, with a focus on pH more so than titratable acidity. So over the past 6 years, we've been looking at two alternative acidification methods. One is enzymatic. It employs the use of glucose oxidase, that is an enzyme that helps transform glucose into gluconic acid, thereby increasing the acidity of the wine and decreasing the pH. So we've done some research on both reds and whites, and that research has been published in peer-reviewed journals. So those are links that I can share with you. And now we are working with Verjus. And that falls within the sustainability category as well, because a little bit of background on what Verjus is and how it can help. So Verjus is the juice of green grapes. It is produced from underripe grapes that are pressed, and the juice obtained is called Verjus, which comes from French, the French language. Jus vert, green juice. So basically it means green juice. And because it's made from underripe grapes, you can imagine there's little sugar in it. The acidity is quite high and the pH is quite low. Traditionally, grape growers can practice this crop thinning practice to manage their crop and crop quality. What they do is they drop some of the grapes on the vine before they ripen in order for all the resources of the vine to be directed to the grapes that are left over. So the grapes that are getting dropped are traditionally, especially in North America, considered waste. Nothing is done with them. They are left on the vineyard floor. I have a European background, right? And I grew up with these grapes being turned into verjus. We have a different name for it in Romanian, but same idea. And this juice was used quite heavily for various culinary practices in Eastern Europe and throughout the Middle East. So remembering that, I thought, well, why not try to take these grapes and make verjus out of them and use that to acidify? It is a natural product. It comes from the vineyard and it gives added value to the grapes, right?
And these grapes, are we talking just past raisin or are we talking still in the berry green hard pea stage?
So verjus traditionally is made pre-raisin. There's not a set date for grape thinning or verjus production. It can vary anywhere from 30 days post-bloom to 45 days post-bloom and the beginning of raisin there.
So tell me more about this. We make some verjus. We collect some berries that haven't gone through raisin yet, and then they're crushed or pressed or something. I'm also curious, can this be done with both red and white varieties?
Again, a very good question. So last year we had our first experiment with verjus and we made it with white from white grapes, Muscat Canelli. This year we are making it from both white and red. We're using different varieties and we're looking a little bit of differently at it. So still, we want to see how it affects wine quality and wine sensory profile. But what we're doing extra this year, so we're doing red and white. And on top of that, we are comparing this method with three other acidification methods, both from a chemical and sensory perspective. So we're looking at, you know, the traditional tartaric acid addition that most wineries do. We're looking at verjus addition. We're looking at the GOX, glucose oxidase, that I mentioned earlier. And we're looking at ion exchange, which is becoming quite popular for pH reduction.
Tell me more about that.
So ion exchange resins are widely used in water treatments, soft water or hard water, depending on what you're trying to achieve. Basically, they're these resins that have been charged and they can release either cations or anions. In our case, the resin that we use releases protons, so hydrogen ions, and then the potassium in the wine gets reduced. And by releasing protons, it increases the number of protons in solution, thereby decreasing the pH. And you basically pump your wine through this ion exchange column that holds the resin and it comes up on the other end.
If I understand correctly, that's also removing the potassium, which is the buffer that's keeping it high. Is that right?
Some of it, yes. Not all of it, but some of it, yes.
Again, this was just a portion of their conversation. To listen to the full episode, visit vineyardteam.org. Stay tuned, we'll have more Ag News after the break.
Over the years, you've brought them into your home. You were prescribed opioids after the C-section and after Dad's back injury. They helped when you were in pain, and you held on to them, just in case. But did you know holding on to unused opioids puts your family at risk? Trouble with opioids can start at home with unused medicines, such as pills, patches, and syrups. You can remove the risk and protect your family. Find out how at www.fda.gov/drugdisposal.
You've been listening to the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now. Smaller operating loans slow ag lending activity. Farm lending activity slowed further in the third quarter alongside a drop in operating loan volumes. The number of new non-real estate farm loans was flat compared to a year ago, while the average size shrank almost 20%. The amount of operating loans over $1 million dropped notably. The Kansas City Fed said lending has softened alongside significant increases in farm loan interest rates that have put considerable upward pressure on financing costs. The farm economy has moderated in recent months as profit margins thinned alongside lower commodity prices and elevated expenses. Credit needs have increased for many borrowers because of high input costs, but strong liquidity built up in recent years has also allowed many producers to supplement additional loan advances. Higher financing costs have prompted farmers with enough liquidity to limit debt usage, but any softening in farm finances could reduce reserves and increase loan demand. An AFB contributed to that report.
A workshop looking at weeds and table grapes is coming up in Parlier next month. Sponsored by UCANR, the Fresno State Viticulture and Enology Research Center, and the California Table Grape Commission, the Weed School for Table Grapes event is scheduled for Tuesday, November 21st at the Kearney Ag Research and Extension Center. Rob Roy with USDA's NRCS will begin the program with a presentation on incentivizing weed management strategies to reduce impacts on water and air quality. Other presentations will also be covering drift prevention, updates on herbicide-resistant weeds, and the basics of vineyard weed management. After the break, there will be demonstrations of sprayer calibration and weed identification out in the vineyard. DPR and CCA credit have been applied for. More information about the workshops available on the upcoming events page at agnetwest.com. I'm Brian German for Agnet West Radio Network.
USDA releases a new report on carbon markets. The USDA has just come out with a report on carbon markets, and USDA's Gary Crawford talks with Undersecretary Robert Bonney in this next report.
A new USDA report on the role of agriculture and forestry in carbon markets says those markets right now show a lot of promise in providing a possible new income stream for farmers, but the report outlines some problems and barriers keeping farmers from being able to fully participate in those markets. USDA Undersecretary Robert Bonney says there is certainly a lot of interest in carbon markets and climate smart production.
You see a lot of interest from companies that buy commodities in greening their supply chain. You see producer groups, whether it's folks in cotton or beef or elsewhere, that are interested in marketing the climate smart practices that go along with their commodities.
However, the USDA report says currently farmers face barriers to actually participating in carbon markets themselves, barriers such as limited returns on investment because of high transaction costs, including cost of accurately measuring and reporting greenhouse reductions. The USDA report says, however, having a detailed look at the barriers will help federal agencies come up with solutions. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
Thanks, Gary. Reporting for Agnet West Radio Network, I'm Danielle Neal.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit Agnet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at Agnet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Danielle Leal, Brian German, and Sabrina Halvertson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the Agnet News Hour from Agnet West. Agnet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.